6 o'clock, live from Westminster. The Prime Minister has offered an apology to her party after suffering humiliating losses in the snap general election.
I had wanted to achieve a larger majority, but that was not the result that we secured. And I'm sorry for all those candidates and hard-working party workers who weren't successful, but also particularly sorry for those colleagues who were MPs and ministers.
Theresa May has a minority government but wants the support of the Democratic Unionist Party and its 10 MPs. The DUP says it'll start talks with the Conservatives about a deal. Sinn Féin President Gerry Adams isn't convinced an alliance will end well.
Remember, the history will show alliances between Ulster Unionism and British Unionism has always ended in tears. That's always been the story. You know, they always end up being betrayed in the end.
Meanwhile, the Prime Minister's announced some cabinet appointments. Several senior ministers are keeping their posts, including the Chancellor, the Home, Foreign, Defence and Brexit secretaries. So, what does this all mean for the Brexit talks, which are meant to start in 10 days? Emma Jones reports.
The President of the European Commission is hoping for no delays.
We can open negotiations tomorrow morning at 9:30.
But other parties want to put the brakes on.
The negotiations should be put on hold.
The reckless Tory pursuit of a hard Brexit must be abandoned.
And EU expert Philippe Legrand thinks the UK's credibility has been damaged.
Now we look like we are a complete joke.
The pound's been hit, but UK shares rose because many firms rely on the euro or dollar.
In other news, Mars is recalling some products over concerns they could be contaminated with salmonella. It's affecting some Galaxy and Maltesers bars and pouches. And in sport, Andy Murray's failed to reach the final of the French Open tennis. The world number one lost his last four clash with Stan Wawrinka in five sets. From Sky News, I'm Elizabeth Williams.
Begin to put the pieces of the puzzle together and begin to work, take an active role, take a risk. Stick it out over the cliff and don't worry about falling off. It's better to fall off trying to save freedom than to die in the chains.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Liberal Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Britain's third terror attack in as many months last Saturday night. Once more, MI5 fail in their primary task. Why hasn't Andrew Parker been sacked? Yes, the second terror attack in Britain in as many weeks and the third in 3 months. London Bridge and nearby Borough Market were last Saturday night the scene of both carnage and heroism. 8 people killed and almost 50 seriously injured and otherwise hospitalised. But enormous questions. Why did the police take several days to release the names when we could have been helping them piece together these maniacs' history? And could it be they didn't want us to see just how close, for the fourth time in as many terror attacks, that's 7-7, Westminster Bridge, Manchester and now London Bridge, the perpetrators were to our secret services? What pressure might have there been at MI5 not to act? And what about the London Bridge attackers' connections over decades to the most extreme and banned groups in Britain? And finally, like the Manchester attacks, Salman Abedi, the local community, had reported the ringleader to the anti-terror hotline several times in Manchester. The police had investigated the London Bridge attacker in January, this January. And also, the attackers had been banned from local mosques. What else are the Muslim communities supposed to do? Imprison suspects themselves to stop them causing mayhem? And what about the motive in 7-7, Manchester and London Bridge? All the terrorists said it was for the deaths of innocent civilians after the invasion of Iraq. Are these blowback attacks simply a result of British foreign policy, which the British people don't support? Plus, Qatar is ostracised by the Gulf states this week, and Tehran suffers an attack on its parliament and the shrine of their revolutionary Imam Khomeini. That's Iran's first attack from ISIS. Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM 93.2 at noon every Tuesday. This week, fake parts being used on Boeing 737 jets. We speak to a whistleblower. And also Bristol's homeless being evicted illegally without going to court by balaclavaed thugs calling themselves GRC bailiffs. You heard a bit about that in the last hour, but there's the full interview on Tuesday at noon. Also, a look at suicides and Bristol University. Are the university doing enough to stop them? And why are they happening? That's Dialect at noon next Tuesday. Listen again at bcfmradio.com/dialect. Or if you can't wait, you can download the show now from dialectradio.co.uk. But Martin, we'll start with this horrific attack last Saturday night in Borough Market and London Bridge.
Well, yes, obviously a very distressing and upsetting. But again, as you pointed out, it turns out that these people were on the radar. And you have to ask the question, is it the case that the police go to the security services and say these people have been fingered as potential terrorists, and then the security services say to them, "Ah, yes, but we know about them, and you've got to realise that we don't really understand what we get up to." In the case of Abadi in Manchester, is associated with the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, and the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group have been given a basic carte blanche to operate from Manchester for many years in purpose of overthrowing Gaddafi. And Abadi himself went to Libya to fight, and he then went potentially to Syria to fight. And of course, British Special Forces are still in Syria working with similar individuals, helping them, training them to fight the Syrian army. And then they come back to Britain and do these things. Now, that could be just blowback because we're being silly by helping these kind of people. But it's also quite possible, and I'm quite sure the Syrian general staff, the Russian general staff, the Iranian general staff, the Iraqi general staff see it in this way, that in actual fact these terrorists are being run by Western intelligence services working with groups.
I mean,
with
you're
the
not
Saudis
suggesting, are you, that that the British secret services are actually actively encouraging these people?
I am suggesting that. And
well,
that's
what evidence have you got?
Well,
for that?
Because the fact is that in all of these cases there are anomalies in what we're looking at, and we've got evidence going back decades that NATO intelligence services engage in false flag terror operations.
Can we just talk about these attacks?
These attacks, all of the individuals, particularly the Manchester attack, I think is absolutely clear there. Abedi's father was arrested by some militia group in Tripoli, in Libya. And Abedi's father is definitely Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, and he's also definitely worked with MI6, because the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group and MI6 have an intimate relationship going back
so
decades.
So is there a mismatch between MI6's policy of recruiting these guys and MI5's duty, and in fact the 1,000 intelligence officers that MI5 have, in stopping terror attacks?
Well,
in
I think the problem with both MI5 and MI6 is that they are not, in fact, police organisations answerable to the authorities. So they have their own strategy for overthrowing Gaddafi, which involves training jihadis in Syria and Libya and so on, and including in making bombs. Very interesting to see who made the bomb in Manchester, because it was a professional-level bomb. And, of course, some senator in the US shouted his mouth off and said it was definitely made with TATP, which is made from hydrogen peroxide, which is basically a hair dye. But, of course, that's the bomb that eventually, they said, had been used in 7-7. Although eventually, when it was pointed out that the bombs didn't behave like a TATTP bomb would do, they then went quiet, and we actually don't know what explosive was used on 7-7. Although a French police officer gave a press conference immediately after the attack, saying what worried them most of all was that they were using C4, which is NATO standard issue explosive. Now, I think if you actually analyse the explosives that are being used,
It's not just you saying this, because there are interviews with experts in explosives saying
absolutely
that this is not homemade explosive about the Manchester attack. Definitely.
Well,
not.
Indeed, and that suggests to me that elements within the US security services, like the CIA, like Mossad, and like MI6, they cooperate with these jihadi groups.
Yeah, but these attacks have been claimed by ISIS.
Yes, but ISIS is, according to the Russian, Syrian, Iraqi and Iranian general staffs, is in fact a front organisation for Saudi Arabia, NATO.
They would say that, wouldn't they?
They would, but they might be right. And the fact is that when people like that say things like that, why is it that we distrust the Russian secret services But our own secret services, we believe everything they say.
Well, look, one slight problem with ISIS claims, both with Manchester and London Bridge, is that Manchester, ISIS said that it was actually a group of people that had made the attack, not a single person, and also that nobody was martyred. So apparently, ISIS is saying that the people that did the Manchester attack got away. Then, on the London Bridge attack, when ISIS claimed that, they actually got the day wrong, the date wrong.
Yeah, well, a lot of the claims by ISIS actually come from Rita Katz's seeking international terrorism on the internet. I can't remember what the...
Search for international terrorist entities.
Entities, that's yeah. Right. In other words, ISIS's propaganda seems to be run by an ex-Mossad intelligence officer based in Langley, Virginia. And, of course, there's very, very big questions about all of these beheading videos with which they emerged onto the scene.
Well, it's not just site, it's also AMAQ news agency, that's spelled A-M-A-Q. But there's doubts about that, too.
There's doubts about that, too. The fact is, ISIS is a very mysterious organisation. But we know, because we've seen the DIA reports which were leaked, that ISIS is supported largely by funders in Saudi Arabia. The same Saudi Arabia that Trump's just visited and Theresa May made a visit to sell weapons to, and so on. And we said, we've got to work with the Saudis, because otherwise, I mean, as Prince Bandar said, if you keep pressing us on this whole thing about corruption and BAE systems, you're going to have more attacks like 7/7 on your streets. He also threatened Putin and said that if Putin didn't do what he wanted in Syria, that the Sochi Winter Olympics would be attacked by Chechen terrorists. And that's because the Saudis, what's really bizarre now, the Qataris are being accused of supporting Islamist terrorism all over the Middle East, and they do, and they're being accused of that by the Saudis, who also support Islamist terrorism all over the Middle East. And of course, both of these countries are allies of NATO, and MI6 are definitely involved. So when we say that MI6, and of course what we're really talking about here is their allies in the CIA and Mossad may be behind these Islamist attacks in Britain, that is a copper's hunch. And what the police, Metropolitan Police Anti-Terrorist Squad and the Manchester Police Anti-Terrorist Squad have got to do is, one of the things they've got to consider is that these individuals have been allowed to operate because they're being run as hands-off agents of our own intelligence services. And in fact, if they prove that that's the case, then I think there'll be a very strong case for the breakup and complete dismantling of both organisations, MI5 and MI6. Let's put the police in charge. Maybe we should bring the Police Service of Northern Ireland in to look at the Manchester Police and the Metropolitan Police if they're not prepared to do the right job.
Is that run by the Orange Order too?
No, it's not. It's independent of the British government. That's the whole point.
Now, when I spoke to former Special Branch Officer Charles Shoebridge last week, that's before the London Bridge attacks, after the Manchester attacks, he was talking to me about how MI5, whether or not MI5 can be trusted when they keep getting it wrong.
At the end of the day, what is the point of having information such as that a terrorist is about to carry out an attack, or may carry out an attack, unless you act on it? And that's in that context that these reports, particularly, they're not verified reports, but if they turn out to be true from the FBI, that the FBI did actually pass that information with specific information, and quite recently, only in 2017 was that information passed to MI5, that would have been a catastrophic failure of intelligence. And again, it needs an independent body to get to the root of why these mistakes are happening and expose the truth, if indeed it's true that these people were being protected by MI5. And the reason that that has to be exposed is to stop it happening again, because it's one thing to protect your sources, but it's another thing to fail at your key task of protecting British lives, particularly British civilians' lives, at a concert. And there's no reason from a security aspect why that kind of decision-making process, why those mistakes can't be publicly discussed. But at the moment, that's very unlikely to happen.
Well, Charles's point, Martin, is that a lot of this policy, they won't discuss what they do, and they're saying that it's not a legitimate point for public discussion, it's all covered by national security.
Well, they would say that, wouldn't they, in the famous words of Mandy Rice Davis.
It does sound, make it sound as if they're guilty, doesn't it? They don't want to talk about this because they know they will be found out.
Well, that's
out.
Why I would argue that the police should have primacy in investigating these incidents.
I mean, one of the articles...
And if they show that there are linkages between the terrorists and the intelligence services, they should arrest their intelligence service handlers. And, you know, if the intelligence services are behind these attacks, then we've got a way to stop them, which is basically bust their intelligence service handlers, and then there won't be any more attacks.
The other point that Charles made last week was that there is really no accountability whatsoever for MI5. The people who are on the Intelligence and Security Committee, and of course there is no Intelligence and Security Committee at the moment because we're between parliaments, the people on that committee are chosen directly by the Prime Minister, and the reports don't go to other members of the House of Commons. They only go to the Prime Minister themselves, so that is only that one individual is any kind of oversight of the intelligence services at all. It's just simply not adequate, is it?
No, it's not. And especially I think that as I've said before, the police must have absolute primacy in investigating these incidents, and what they may discover is that the intelligence services have been lax in not keeping tabs on these people. What they may also discover is, in actual fact, they've encouraged them.
Yes, and in fact, we'll be talking now about an article in Medium.com written by an old friend of ours, actually, Nafiz Ahmed, who did the book about the 7/7 attacks back in 2005. I think he published, I think, in 2006. I always remember hearing that he wanted to put in his book alleged bombers, even though they were dead, and the publishers wouldn't publish the book unless they got rid of the word alleged, because he didn't believe that there was really enough evidence to absolutely 100% say that they had done it. So anyway, the article's SIS recruiter who radicalised London Bridge attackers was protected by MI5 in Medium.com, and I'll put the link to that on our show page, from collusion to blowback. And in this article, Martin, he also talks about the police officers telling him that there were people from MI5 leaning on them not to pursue investigations.
Well, I think what happens is, if you think about it, is that people in the Muslim community get suspicious and they dob people in to the police. The police then go to the intelligence services and say, well, we've had some information that these people are dangerous. And the intelligence services say, well, don't worry about them, we've got an eye on them, and we don't want you to do anything. And therefore, the police then have to back off. And M. Chowdhury, who was an associate of one of the attackers on London Bridge, is known to be an MI5 double agent. And of course, many of the more famous Islamic radicals like Abu Hamza and Harun Ashwat, who was supposedly the mastermind of 7/7, are all working for MI5. Al-Majid Harun, which is a very, very sort of scary pirate-style Islamist outfit, is virtually, you know, we now know, is virtually 100% MI5 controlled. So they took over, they tried to take over Finsbury Park Mosque, and the Finsbury Park Mosque elders tried to kick them out. This has happened in quite a few mosques. It's happened in Birmingham Central Mosque as well. And it turns out that these people who are trying to take over and push their extremist views are, in fact, working with the intelligence services.
I wonder who are Al-Majarun, who were Al-Majarun, an old friend
Indeed.
Of mine. As an old friend of mine, it used to squat in Brixton, actually, and they were evicted, only to come back the next week and find out that Al-Majarun had moved in.
That's right. Well, Abu Hamza, you know, Captain Hook, the one, he was working for MI5 for years, and he was basically encouraged to go out and make extremist remarks so that the police could then supposedly, or rather MI5 could then supposedly, you know, see who was actually up for doing dangerous things.
The elders at Finsbury Park Mosque famously contacted the police and said, get these maniacs, please help us get them out of our mosque, and they did nothing. And
no,
then,
because they're happened? Working for them.
And what happened after was 2005, the 7/7 London bombings.
Indeed, and Harun Aswat was named by the Metropolitan Police as the mastermind because he'd been on the phone to all four of the bombers the day before. But now he was then taken into protective custody, and then he went mad, and he's now in Broadmoor.
He's been extradited to the US on a completely different case, charge.
Yeah.
So now, he's out of the way now.
Yeah, that's right. And of course, many of these people either just get whisked away or they end up dead so that nobody can ask any questions. I think there's a pattern here that goes back to the 1980s, which is the use of Wahhabi, Salafist extremism all over the world by Western intelligence services to create false flag attacks, which then justify more power for the intelligence services, military interventions in foreign countries, etc. And I think the evidence going back
30 or 40 years is pretty clear. And it's not something that we used to do and have stopped doing in Libya and Syria. It's absolutely... what gets me about the Qataris being accused of being supporting terrorism is that it's right. All the list is right there. They are supporting terrorism, and they're given a list of the terrorists they support. But these terrorists are also supported by the British, the Americans and the Saudis.
One of the things that Nafees Ahmed says is that, according to press reports, both Kuram Butt from this attack last weekend and Rashid Redouane were long-standing members of the proscribed extremist network, formerly known as Al-Mujahroon. After 9/11, the group operated under different names, such as Sharia for UK, Muslims for Crusades, and Islam for UK. Originally founded by Lebanese firebrand Omar Bakri Mohammed, who was banned from returning to the UK after 7/7, the network was later run by Bakri's deputy Anjam Chowdhury. He was convicted in 2016 for supporting and encouraging support for ISIS. Yet the press has largely ignored the extent to which Chowdhury's uncanny freedom to operate in Britain and to send British Muslims to fight in foreign theatres was linked to his opaque relationship to Britain's security services.
Well, that's right. I mean, we've got the most more Islamic extremists per head in Britain than any other country, and that's because MI6 was the lead agency on Operation Cyclone in the 1980s, seconded by the CIA to be the lead agency, and we brought particularly Libyans, but not just Libyans, for all sorts of extremists from all over the world were brought to Britain for training by our special forces, and then to be infiltrated into Afghanistan, Syria, Libya, etc. And that's why they're all here. Pretty silly. And of course it's worse than that. It's not just that we've been very silly in cooperating with these groups. It may well be that security services are behind the whole terrorist campaign that we're being subjected to.
Well, Kuram Butt was known, this is the ringleader last Saturday night, to counter-terrorism police and MI5, who investigated him in 2015. And we've heard also that he was investigated this year, 2017, in January, again, by the police. The official line is that he was deprioritised, as no evidence of any attack planning was found. Anonymous British counter-terrorism sources, however, told CNN that Butt was the subject of a full package of investigatory measures, as he was believed to be one of the most dangerous extremists in the UK. That's to quote them. After September 2014, when ISIS began calling for attacks on the West, British security services grew increasingly concerned that Al-Mujahroon members who'd remained in the UK were carrying out terrorist attacks. The sources said one of them they were most concerned about was Butt. Now, if this guy is being associated with these extremist groups for decades, and he's at the top of the terror watch list, and he then goes and hires a van, and that van is very obviously parked in the middle of the street where he was living, and the local community are dobbing him in, phoning up the anti-terror hotline, and also banning him from mosques. Why on earth have MI5 just left him to get on with this attack?
Well, it's what analysis of this kind of situation called LIHOP, let it happen on purpose. And then there's MIHOP, made it happen on purpose. I suggest the bombing in Manchester, because of the sophistication of the bomb, may well be a MIHOP. In other words, British Special Forces may have had a direct or indirect hand in building the bomb. Or it could be Israeli Special Forces, or it could be American Special Forces. When people carry out attacks with knives and so on, though you don't need it, it's not very sophisticated stuff, we'd call that let it happen on purpose. The first attack on London Bridge... we were told that there were the initial police reports were that there were two attackers. A white bald man was also named, but then
you mean the Westminster Bridge?
Yeah, right. Westminster Bridge, and then it became one attacker, and then it became clear that there was no CCTV footage of the attack, because Westminster Council had, on a cost-saving measure, switched off the CCTV around Parliament. Can you believe
and
that?
And yes, and also that the armed guard had been taken off of the entrances to Parliament, because we're supposed to believe this, that the armed police felt threatened and exposed there. Now, that, of course, means that you would have to take off any armed guards off of all the military bases in the Western world.
Yes, all of these things suggest that maybe the intelligence services know more about these attacks than they're letting on. And of course, we know that they've been engaged in false flag terrorist attacks using Islamists going back to the 1980s. It's now 2017. The story is that we set up an international Islamic brigade to fight in Afghanistan, many of them from Libya, and we armed and trained them and gave them special forces training, and then they went rogue and we couldn't stop them. But I think what's happened in Libya and Syria in the last 2 years makes it absolutely clear that the policy of supporting Islamist terrorism for geopolitical reasons is alive and well, and nothing has changed.
Kuran Butt was also in a Channel 4 documentary last year called The Jihadis Next Door, calling for this sort of attack.
Yes, and of course, if you're the intelligence services trying to create an effect, having a documentary where this guy does threatening things and then he goes out and does something, and then, of course, you turn around and say, oh, well, we need more resources to try and deal with this terrible problem, but don't ask what we're actually doing because we're not going to tell you. And, of course, it becomes... I mean, this guy called Gilo, I think his name was, this Swedish guy put on trial at the Old Bailey by West Midlands Police for threatening to go to Syria to join al-Nusra Front. He then, his lawyers, defended himself perfectly adequately by saying, yes, but the al-Nusra Front, he was recruited by MI6 and the al-Nusra Front are supported by MI6. They had to let him go. So we've got a court case where the security services were basically fingered for supporting al-Nusra, which is al-Qaeda, in Syria. And, of course, they're not just supporting it in Syria. They also support it in Britain and the US, and they're actually probably behind all of these attacks. We can't prove it yet. But if the police carry out an independent investigation with no holes barred, maybe we will start to get to the bottom of all of this.
At a protest about Lee Rigby, Kuran Butt also attempted to assault somebody. I mean, it's quite obvious, sorry, to MI5, that this guy is something, you know, needs to be done about him. And at the very least, a very close watch should be kept on him, very, very close. And, of course, that didn't happen. Why hasn't Andrew Parker, who's the Director General of MI5, why hasn't he now been sacked after these three attacks in 3 months and two attacks in 2 weeks? Where, obviously, well, because these people are very close to MI5.
Because the intelligence services operate outside of the political system. There's no accountability.
And it's they take our money, though, don't they?
They do, indeed. And, in fact, British Special Forces take our money to train these people in Libya. That's what they do. They went to Libya and they train these people how to make bombs. And then they come back and bomb us. But we're paying for it all.
Peter Oborne wrote an article in the Daily Mail this week saying why MI5 must share the blame for the jihadis in our midst. I mean, he's really pointing the finger at MI5. But some people might say that MI6... he's exonerating MI5. And he's saying, actually, it's MI6 that's the source of the problem.
Yeah, well, if you remember when Dave Shaler and Annie Machon split from MI5 in the 90s, they said it was MI6 that came to the Libya desk in MI5 and said, we're going to use the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group to try and assassinate Gaddafi. And it was the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group based in Manchester. And they provided $30,000 to the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group for an assassination attempt on Gaddafi, which failed, killing several civilians. But that was definitely MI6, definitely Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, definitely working together 25 years ago. And I suspect they're still working together today.
Now, Martin, I understand there's quite a lot going on at the moment, looking at the way that this is being reported, because I suppose the most shocking thing for me is that we had no press criticism of the police for withholding the names for several days of these attackers, and really effectively acting almost as if whatever MI5 say is the truth, because the fact of the matter is, as we were hearing from Charles Shoebridge last week, that most of the Home Affairs correspondents in the London press actually act as MI5 press officers.
Well, that's right. It's a continuous creation of... a created reality is made, isn't it, by the intelligence services manipulating the media and then the media manipulating the masses.
Now, I understand the media are actually on trial on Sunday down in Frome. What exactly is happening?
It's an event called Media on Trial, where they've got some very good speakers. Peter Ford, who I think we're going to hear from in a minute, who was the former British ambassador to Syria, and Vanessa Beely, who is an independent journalist. I think her father was a British ambassador, but she's also been reporting from Syria independently about what's been going on there. Because, of course, the British
have been supporting armed jihadis in Syria for the last 5 years. Roland Dumas, the former French foreign minister, said as much on French TV 2 or 3 years ago. The British wanted to start an armed uprising in Syria, and they armed and trained the jihadis who were trying to overthrow the Syrian government. These are exactly the same people who then come back and carry out attacks in the West.
Well, it's taking place at 7 o'clock on Sunday night. Do you know where, Martin?
It's called Grain and...
What's it called? It's called Grain and something.
It's a Whole Food shop.
Okay, cheese and grain.
Cheese and grain.
In Frome. I'll put a link up to it on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But we've got two serious problems here. We've got blowback going on from British foreign policy and terrorist attacks, which appear to be being facilitated by MI5, who are completely invulnerable. And the Director General, Andrew Parker, who did the spin work for the 7/7 attacks and was then promoted for that, he can't be sacked, it seems. Nobody wants to sack him, even though he's not doing his job. So I spoke about the effect over in the Middle East of some of this, and particularly Syria, to the former ambassador to Syria, who's speaking at this meeting down in Frome on Sunday night, and his name is Peter Ford.
I'm Peter Ford. I was ambassador to Syria between 2002 and 2006. Before that, I was ambassador in Bahrain, and I'm a Foreign Office career Arabist. After leaving the Foreign Office 10 years ago, I joined the UN, and I worked with refugees in the Middle East for 8 years before more or less retiring 2 years ago.
Now, I can remember in the first Gulf War in the early 1990s, we had the invention of this rolling news on the brand new Radio 5, and there was a whole plethora of BBC correspondents giving us the history of the Middle East. Nowadays, very, very little of the history. So can you just give us a brief account of how we got where we are with Syria?
Well, Syria was created artificially by the British and the French in the carve-up of the Ottoman Empire at the end of the First World War. So that's the first point to realise, that Syrians consider that we, the West, lopped off large portions of their territory, including what's now Lebanon and parts of Iraq and Jordan, that we lopped off parts of what's called Greater Syria. That's the first point to bear in mind, that Syria used to be a bigger, more important country before
Now, you mentioned the Six-Day War there. It's this week, it's 50 years ago. What's the significance of that?
The significance is that the Israelis have held on to this conquered territory, the Golan Heights, for 50 years. By conquest, it's held under illegal occupation. There are many UN resolutions calling on Israelis to withdraw, but they haven't. The Israelis had not withdrawn from the Golan, and they've gone about colonising it.
Looking back, you mentioned the UN resolutions. It does look as if this was a real sticking point. The UN couldn't get these resolutions enforced. These are Security Council resolutions, and if you can't enforce them, then this leads to precedents for the future.
Absolutely. The famous resolution 242, which called for withdrawal from all occupied territories, is the main one that wasn't complied with by Israel and was protected by a succession of American vetoes on that count.
Now, they would say, we need this for self-defence. We're surrounded by these hostile Arab countries. We need that, those high, you know, the mountain, the high country.
Well, I don't know how long you've got, Tony, but there are many points to counter that. The basic point is that Syria does not represent and has not represented a military threat to Israel for many, many years. Israel has a very powerful army, has nuclear weapons, is well capable of looking after itself, and is backed to the hilt by the United States. Syria, in fact, has ensured that for 50 years there's been no trouble on the Golan. The Syrians have prevented any jihadis or fedayeen crossing that sensitive border, but they get no thanks for ensuring that northern Israel is safe in this way. No, the occupation, the rest of the world agrees, is illegal. You can't just grab territory because you're afraid of your neighbour. You have to give it up. But the Israelis have been very comfortable for 50 years continuing their occupation. And remember, there are Syrians. There's a Syrian population living under occupation. They have rights too.
Now, what you're saying, we're not really hearing very much from the Foreign Office. Why do you think that might be?
Because Syria was or used to be part of the Soviet bloc, and then after things deteriorated more recently, part of the Russian sphere of influence, and therefore the Foreign Office doesn't give a damn about legality or the rights of Syrians.
What about the Assad family? Because I understand they've got quite a lot of connections with Britain.
Yes, President Assad studied to be an eye doctor in London for a couple of years, and his wife, whom he met while he was studying, Asma al-Assad, is a Syrian who grew up in London. Her father is an eminent Harley Street cardiologist who still lives in London.
What about the balance of the media? The way that the media has treated Syria since 2011, when this so-called civil war first started. Was it a civil war or not?
It's partly a civil war, Syrians fighting Syrians, but it also has a very big external component that just about everybody has jumped in to interfere. The Americans, the Russians, the Iranians, the Saudis, the Qataris, the British, the French, just about everybody has been doing their best to make things worse. And each party has got its own proxy group of fighters.
What is the importance, do you think, strategically of Syria then? Why have so many countries taken an interest in trying to get regime change there?
Partly because of this struggle between the so-called free world that Theresa May keeps going on about, and Donald Trump, the free world, and the unfree world. This is a Cold War way of thinking, so that's a big part of it, that it's seen as a somewhere to arm wrestle with the
Can you point to any spin, we might call it, we used to call it spin, that you've seen in the interpretation of what's been going on in Syria over there? Are there some incidents that you can point to that illustrate that perhaps we're not being told the whole truth about what's been going on there?
Well, most recently, the alleged use of chemical weapons in Idlib in northern Syria. There is a UN investigation underway. Nevertheless, the media almost invariably refer to it as an established fact that the Assad regime did it, and they don't mention that the jury is still out, that there are grounds for believing that the Assad people didn't do it. This is one very important example. And then there's the constant stereotyping. The Syrian government is usually described as a regime, whereas countries that we like in the Arab world, like Saudi Arabia, even though they never have elections, unlike Syria, are simply described as nice little kingdoms. But Syria is a regime, and its ruler is generally described as a dictator, even though Syria does have elections, imperfect though they may be, but that's a lot more than our Saudi friends have. So there's this constant vilifying, demonizing, stereotyping, and a general framing of things so that Syria is cast as the bad guy.
Damascus, you've spent a bit of time there. Tell us what sort of city it used to be compared to the frightening lives people have to live now.
When I was there, and I left in 2006, Syria was the safest place in the Middle East. You could go anywhere at all in the country and not fear for your personal safety. It was a haven. There were undercurrents of violence, and there was a moment when I was the subject of an attempted assassination by a group of jihadis, but by and large, it was a safer place to be than, say, Miami, or, dare I say it today, London.
Tell us about that attempt on your life.
I was in my ambassador's residence in central Damascus, and a group of the four jihadis armed with rocket-propelled grenades and rifles attacked the house, but they were fought off by the Syrian police guards, who were always there 24 hours a day, and I believe they were caught and punished, although we never really got to the bottom of it. It appeared that they were jihadis, however, who may have come across from Iraq.
Also this week we've seen the first attack in Tehran by ISIS. Do you think that's significant?
Yes, it is, on several levels. First of all, it shows that ISIS have a deep grudge against Iran, and that Iran is a victim of this terrorism as much as we all are. And this is despite Donald Trump's recent attempt to get the Gulf countries to gang up against Iran, and his claim that it was Iran which was actually the fountainhead of terror, which was a ludicrous claim to make when everyone knows that Saudi Arabia is the fountainhead of terror.
Interesting also that Qatar's been singled out this week by the Gulf states. Why do you think that is, if, as you say, the Saudis are actually just as guilty?
Oh, this is precisely because in recent months Qatar has been hedging its bets and has been talking to Iran. This has really got the Saudis' goat, and they are trying to bring the Qataris back into line. But this is a case of the pot calling the kettle black.
We also heard this week about permanent US bases being set up in Syria. What do you make of that?
Well, the generals have got their head under the Donald. The Donald never said no to a uniform, and he's let his mad generals take over. Remember the nickname of the top general is Mad Dog, and that's for a reason.
Oh, that's Mattis.
Yes, yes, he glories in his nickname as Mad Dog, and he is a particular vendetta against Iran because of an incident in the 1980s in Beirut when American Marines, who at that time had no right to be in Beirut, were attacked and killed by some militias loyal to Tehran.
What do you think's the implications geopolitically for the US setting up permanent bases in Syria?
It's horrific. It's horrific. We saw just a couple of days ago how the Americans, so-called defending themselves in one of these bases in a place on the border with Iraq and Jordan and Syria, how they attacked from the air nearby Syrian government forces. This is doubly illegal. First of all, they have no right to be in Syria at all, no mandate from the UN or agreement from the Syrian government, not even a mandate from Congress. And secondly, they are hampering the fight against ISIS because the Syrian government forces have actually been making headway in this area against ISIS. But let me tell you this, that the British are involved there too. We have had a contingent of special forces at this base, but our government doesn't see fit to tell us about this. They too have no mandate to be in Syria at all, and no mandate from the British Parliament. We were promised, you recall, Tony, back when Parliament was debating whether Britain should be bombing in Syria 18 months ago, we were told that there would be no ground troops. Well, there are, or there have been. They may have been withdrawn just in the last week in this pre-election period, just in case there was an accident. But we have had ground troops in Syria as well.
Oh, it does make it possibly difficult for an ambassador to negotiate when there are unofficial troops, special forces in a country doing operations that haven't been sanctioned by the government.
Well, of course, a bit of military clout can strengthen an ambassador's hand, but if we're talking about peacemaking, then all the foreign forces need to withdraw from Syria. This would settle the Syrian issue. Is all foreign forces, including not just the Americans and ourselves, but also the Russians and the Iranians. But you can't blame the Syrian government for hanging on to the Russians and the Iranians while we, the West, persist and insist on backing our proxies. We are shamelessly training and equipping with taxpayer money hundreds of jihadis just so that they can topple Assad. That is the scandal.
Well, there's also another scandal, and that is that a lot of people are talking about blowback, that is to say jihadis that potentially MI6 or the British anyway have trained, now coming back to Britain and causing terrorist attacks for the last few months here in Britain.
It's ludicrous to claim, as many people do, that there's no connection with our foreign policy. The sister of Habibi, the Manchester bomber, was quite explicit that he did it because he was angry and upset about Western bombing of Muslims in Syria and Iraq. Now, of course, this is a perverted, totally obscene way to behave, but our actions do have consequences. If our government really thinks that it's worth the risk, that our bombing in Syria is worth the risk of a Manchester or a London bridge, they should be honest with us and tell us that this is a price we have to pay. But they don't tell us that. They're in denial. They try to make us think that there's no connection. This is ludicrous.
So is there a bit of a mismatch between the MI6 foreign policy and the MI5's mandate to protect us from terrorists?
Yes, that's one way of looking at it. Well, a few years ago, we do know that MI5, in the run-up to Iraq, MI5, the head of MI5, did warn that there was going to be blowback. Don't blame MI6 here. They're only an instrument. It's the politicians
that was Peter Ford. He's the former British ambassador to Syria, and he'll be speaking at the weekend, Martin.
Yes, he'll be speaking at Cheese and Grain in Frome at 7 o'clock on Sunday. Other speakers is Patrick Henningsen from 21st Century Wire, excellent speaker. Professor Piers Robinson, I don't know much about him. Robert Stewart, don't know much about him. Professor
Tim
Hayward.
Of the talk is what?
The title of the talk is Media on Trial. And also Vanessa Bealey will be speaking, who's a journalist that's been very active in Syria.
So this is really all about the war on information, fake news.
It's basically a very distinguished panel looking at the way the media distort reality.
Now, we heard from the Saker at Christmas, didn't we not, that modern warfare is 80% psychological warfare, 15% economic warfare, and only 5% fighting.
Well, that's an assessment. I mean, obviously, what goes on...
Would you agree with that?
Well, I think it depends. I mean, in the kind of war we're in at the minute, manipulating opinion and using false flag terrorist attacks, for example, that's clearly what's going on. But, of course, if you do go to a full-out war, then it's a different story. The actual planes, tanks, missiles start to count for more. Let's hope we're not going to go there, but we could.
Peter Ford there talked about the British Army in Syria without any mandate from the British public or Parliament.
That's right. In fact, what they're doing is illegal under international law, and if, for example, the Syrian army were to catch them and blow their brains out, they wouldn't really have much of a leg to stand
on,
would they?
That's not necessarily going to be... Well, actually, the Syrians are threatening to do that because just this
week... Yes, they are.
We've seen new strikes from the US on pro-Syrian forces, and it looks like there's some sort of reaction to that. The Iranian-backed militias have been employing drones against US forces just literally in the last 24 hours.
Well, as Peter Ford pointed out, what Donald Trump has now done is he's just said to his generals, McMaster and Mattis, that they can just call in airstrikes whenever they want, do whatever they want in Syria. He's hands off, that's their decision. So the generals could start a war with the Syrian army, the British army will be involved, and then, of course, we're going to war with Russia. I think Theresa May needs to think about this before she speaks to the DUP, maybe.
Now, both these mad generals that he mentioned there, Mattis and McMaster, are both very anti-Iran, aren't they?
They are, and of course this attack on Qatar...
I was wanting to talk about the attack on Tehran this week ISIS.
Well, that's right. But I mean,
attack on the parliament and also on the shrine of the revolutionary Islamic League.
Yes, and it killed quite a few civilians have been killed. But of course we're not being... there's going to be no anniversary concerts and so on for these people. But of course the Iranians are pretty clear that this is Saudis behind this, and they think the Saudis working with Western Intelligence Services, CIA, MI6. And the Israelis. And so, you know, when we carry out terrorist attacks, what Trump said about it is countries that support terrorism should not be surprised if terrorist attacks take place on their soil. And you feel like saying, yes, well, that'd be the British and the Americans and the Saudis, who are the main supporters of Wahhabi terrorism all over the
so
world.
So much of this, Martin, has started 40 years ago, didn't it? The Six-Day War. Actually, no, it's 50 years ago, sorry, exactly this week, from the 5th to the 10th of June in Israel.
Well, it's important.
One of the starting things, you know, really. What the Americans, it seems to me, have done, and the British, is go into the Middle East in support of that occupation.
Yes, but also for their own interests in terms of controlling resources and geopolitical struggles against their enemies, the Russians and the Chinese. People in the Middle East are pretty fed up of the West's attitude towards them, and you can hardly blame them, can you?
Okay, time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7, coming up live on Facebook, Arabian Nights, with Mohammed Makawi and Yusuf, we hope. Thanks to our guests in the first hour, leader of the Lib Dems on Bristol City Council, Councillor for Knowle, Gary Hopkins. Also, you just heard Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and former ambassador to Syria, Peter Ford. This show's story links and comment pages, one word, thisweek.org.uk. You'll find me on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable and sunny BCFM weekend. I'll leave you with music from 2017. That's much more up to date than usual. That's Captain Scar. Do please join us for the politics show at the same time next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
We have a mission to make Britain a country that works, not for the privileged and not for the few, but for every one of our citizens. that. And together, we, the Conservative Party, can build a better Britain.
She's a liar, liar. She's a liar, liar. No, you can't trust her. No, 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 no. She's a liar, liar. She's a liar, liar. No, you can't trust her. No, 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 no. We all know politicians like telling lies. Big ones, little ones, porcupines. Saying they're strong and stable, won't disguise. We're still being taken for a ride. The nurses going hungry, schools in decline. I don't recognize this broken country of mine. They're having a laugh, they show them the door. Then cut the rich, not the poor.
I've been very clear that I think we need that period of time, that stability, to be able to deal with the issues that the country is facing. I'm not going to be calling a snap election.
She's a liar, liar. She's a liar, liar. No, you can't trust her. No, 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 no. She's a liar, liar. She's a liar, liar. No, you can't trust her. No, 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 no.
I want to have a government that doesn't think that fascism is where it's at. 'Cause putting the mother of all bombs into tiny hands can go very wrong. I'm hoping for a future for my child where she can grow and feel inspired. Do everything in your power you can. People rising up is the only plan.
When future generations look back at this time, they will judge us not only by the decision that we made, but by what we made of that decision. They will see that we shaped them a brighter future. They will know that we built them a better Britain.
She's a liar, liar. She's a liar, liar.
This is Bristol BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.